Margaret Bailey lived the life she sang about, and it's all there in her music, in her recordings, swinging lightly and politely, and a joy forever.
Alec Wilder Remembers Mildred Bailey is a production of the South Carolina Educational Radio Network, directed by Tom Sheely, written and produced by Dick Phipps.
Material for this edition of Options was provided by public station WLTR, Columbia, South Carolina. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Fred Calland. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 9 minutes after 3 o'clock. We still have 8 sets of tickets to give away to the Preservation Hall Jazz Band concert, and we'll be doing that a little later in the show. Some of the people who we just heard from, particularly Alec Wilder, used to hang around the Commodore Record Shop, the shop run by my guest, Milt Gabler. Milt Gabler has been a very important figure in jazz because of his shop and his Commodore record label, for which he produced new sessions and reissued earlier recordings. He was about the first person to create reissues and to create a market for them. He also ran a number of jazz concert series. In 1926, when he was a teenager, he started working in his father's shop, the Commodore Radio Shop at 136 East 42nd Street, opposite the Chrysler Building and diagonally across from the Hotel Commodore. Well, Milt Gabler turned the radio shop into the Commodore Record Shop. It became the gathering place for musicians, jazz fans, and writers. With the success of this shop, he opened a second on 52nd Street, which had become the place to hear music. Gabler also formed a record label, the Commodore Record Label. He recorded his own sessions with musicians and reissued musicians' earlier work. Commodore featured recordings of Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Chew Berry, Ben Webster, Jelly Roll Morton, among others. It was Milt Gabler who recorded Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, which her own record company did not really want to record because of the racial overtones of the lyrics. Gabler also organized, and this was in 1935, the United Hot Clubs of America. This led to Gabler's organizing concerts and jam sessions where musicians ranging from Eddie Condon to Ben Webster were invited to play. When Jack Capp asked Gabler to produce reissue records at Decca, he agreed to do it on a part-time basis. Well, he ended up staying with Decca for about 30 years. Decca became a part of MCA Records. Milt Gabler kept up the Commodore label and kept the Commodore Music Shop open until 1958, when chain store competition and discount record stores made it difficult to keep open. Some of the Commodore recordings were reissued in the early 1970s by Atlantic Records. They have since gone out of print. Now, some of these recordings are about to become available again. 10 albums will be reissued this month by Columbia Records as part of the Columbia Special Products series. There will be 10 releases with Jelly Roll Morton, Billie Holiday, Lester Young, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Don Byas, Eddie Condon, Wild Bill Davison, Jack Teagarden, Max Kaminsky, Bud Freeman, Mel Powell, and Joe Bushkin. Well, in celebration of this release, and in honor of his contributions to the world of jazz, the Penn Jersey Jazz Friends are going to give a concert to honor Milt Gabler, and they'll be presenting him with a special award. Performing will be Jimmy Ryan's All-Stars, featuring Roy Eldridge on trumpet, and that will be this Sunday night at the Mallard Inn on Route 73 at Exit 4. You can call Joe Siegel for reservations for this and for any more information at area code 215-637-0760. Milt Gabler has made a special trip from his home in New York to spend this afternoon with us on Fresh Air. Now, by the way, I've told you about half of his career, the jazz half. Now, there's another half in pop music, like the lyrics he wrote to tunes like Choo 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 Boogie and the 21 records that he produced that sold over 1 million copies, including Rock Around the Clock. We're not going to have time to get into this aspect of his career today, but maybe Milt Gabler can join us again sometime soon to discuss the other half of his work. Well, Milt Gabler, it's a great, great pleasure to have you here this afternoon. I want to give you a very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
We're going to be listening to a lot of the records that you've produced on the Commodore record label that are about to be reissued on Columbia Special Products, but
right.
First...
I want to clarify that.
Okay.
They're being reissued by Columbia Special Products, but the great old Commodore label is coming back. They'll be called Commodore, And that's a big thing to a lot of collectors and fans. I correspond with people all over the world, and it seems that even as far away as Japan, they want the Commodore label, that maroon label, with the gold lettering, back in circulation again. And that's what Columbia Special Products is doing. They're putting out Commodore.
Well, both your label and the Commodore Record Shop have become legends in jazz. So I'd like to go back to 1926 when you started at the shop. How did you get there?
Well, actually, the store was a radio and electrical store called the Commodore Radio Shop, the 42nd Street store. The original radio shop was at 144 East 42nd, a little 9-foot store. And I worked there after school. I purposely went to Stuyvesant High School from the Bronx to be near my dad's radio shop, because I had to work there after school. I would do my homework in the back and wait on customers or run errands, whatever. And we used to play a loudspeaker outside the door to attract passers-by, you know, to let them know that there was a radio shop there. But I would always keep popular music on and on the speaker, and people came in and said, "Do you sell phonograph records?" Well, it didn't take me long to realize that we should have phonograph records in the shop, not just radio parts for hams and little radio sets, etc. So I told my father that we ought to take in records. So he said, "I don't know anything about music." I said, "I know everything about music. I know every song there is," like any teenager would tell his dad. And he said, "Well, you call up Columbia and Victor or somebody and get a salesman here, see what it takes to sell records." And I called Columbia and Brunswick. I couldn't get RCA Victor. They used to have restricted agencies in those days, just like automobile dealers probably have today. And I got Victor's a couple of years later, but I had Columbia and Harmony, and I got in Perfect Four for Dollar Records and Harmony Records and OK Records, and I was happy. I was selling popular music.
The store not only was a store, but it was a hangout from what I know about
that
it. People
became,
used to just come there and listen, I guess, and meet with other people, too.
Well, that happened years later. In the beginning, in 1926, I didn't know anything about jazz, although I used to like hot music, what I called hot music. My favorite things as a young man were, the St. Louis Blues had come out, and that was a big smash song. And I never forget, it was before we sold records. Just before, I think St. Louis Blues came out in 1926, and it might just be coincidental that I took in records about that time. But I went to a record shop on East 42nd Street near 2nd Avenue. We were between 3rd and Lex. That was where the Victor dealer was. And I went in there, and I asked for a record of the St. Louis Blues, because I was crazy about the song. And he said, "I have one by Paul Whiteman." I said, "Terrific, I'll take it," because Whiteman was a big name in those years. And I took the record home and played it, and I was very disappointed in the recording of it. It was too concertized. It didn't sound the way I liked to hear the St. Louis Blues when I went to a dance or something. And I went back, and I got the Ted Lewis record of it, which is the way I wanted it played, which was like a Dixieland jazz band record. And it shows you that even in those days, you could buy a wrong record just by buying it by title with a good name on it if you didn't hear it on the air. Today you would hear it on the air or in a jukebox. But I, even at 15 years of age, had a preference for the way the music was played. And I didn't like the big band arrangement of it.
And you tried to create an environment within the shop, I guess, so that people could hear
what
the music was.
That came about all by itself because of the types of records that I sold and specialized in. I don't think it took until probably 1932 or 33 before there were any hot fans coming into the store. in the beginning, I just saw whatever popular records came out. You know, if it was Get Out and Get Under the Moon, I would sell that by Ben Selvin or whoever recorded it. And the salesman would come in with the titles of the week's releases, and I would pick them out. I remember I used to, in those days, they put the writers under the titles of the songs, so I would notice which ones were by Gershwin or Irving Berlin, and you'd get to know that those were better songs, generally. And so you learned about the composers also. But I didn't know who played on a record or anything. Of course, you knew the advertise and popular bands like Ted Lewis and Paul Whiteman, but it wasn't considered jazz to me. You know, actually, in the old days, when the good old songs of the standards today came out in the middle 20s and the late 20s, when you heard them by a small band, it was a kind of a jazz band. It wasn't arranged, and it was really played for dancing. Nobody looked at it as a jazz record. It was only when you got into the 30s and you began to pick out soloists and records that started to swing a little bit, and you started to learn about Louis and King Oliver and Duke Ellington, that you started to, although in the old days we didn't think Duke Ellington could swing.
Really?
Yeah. No. We didn't use the word swing in the early days, and I'll get to that later, how we, when we formed the Hot Club, we actually promoted the word swing to, like it was a new kind of music, in order to get space in magazines and newspapers for the jazz musicians to get more work because they were playing swing.
Well, Milt Gaylor, before we talk some more about your shop, I'm really anxious for our listeners to get a taste of some of the music that you recorded. So let's listen to what was, I guess, the first record that you made for the Commodore record label, for your record label.
Right.
Want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I had been reissuing a jazz record. This, now you're up to 1938.
We're going to go back again, but I just want to get a little taste of it.
This was the first session I did. Eddie Condon used to be a habitué of the Commodore Music Shop. That time it was no more Radio Shop. And he had been coming in for quite a number of years at that point. And, of course, the bands in Greenwich Village and on 52nd Street by 1938, the big bands were here, too, the bands like Benny Goodman and all, and Tommy and everybody. And what happened was, from about 1933 or 4, I reissued my first record, and this is now 4 years later. We had formed a jazz club called the United Hot Clubs of America. The New York branch was called the New York Hot Club of New York. And I used to run jazz concerts at the record studios and get the press there to publicize jazz music. And I reissued all the gems that the big companies had discontinued selling. I would order enough for them to press it for me. And by 1938, or 37 to 38, the market had been created for jazz collecting and jazz music, and John Hammond was hired by Columbia to reissue their great catalog, which I had been using as well as Jeanette's and stuff like that. And I could see the handwriting on the wall, because our reissue sold for a dollar, and even some were even a dollar and a half. I had to make new masters and things. And they were going to put them out. They reduced the price of the records to 50 cents. And I said, well, if they're going to sell them for 50 cents, I better stop making $1 records of similar things. And so I said, I better make records that they can't stop me from selling and I'll have exclusively. And I got a hold of Eddie and I said, let's get some of our favorite guys together and try and recreate the stuff you did like you were young, when you were younger in Chicago. I really wanted to get a sound like the Chicago Rhythm Kings. I found a new baby, and there'll be some changes made, but the men, of course, by 1938, 10 years later, were more proficient with their horns. They were better musicians. They had been used to jamming more, and when I got them together, it didn't come out like the Chicago Rhythm Kings records, but it came out the way you're going to hear it now. Let's play Love Is Just Around the Corner, the first one I ever cut.
Eddie Condon, and what we just heard was the first session that Milt Gabler recorded for his Commodore record label. As he explained, he had done some reissues before that, but this was the first session that he produced himself. Do you want to tell us who else was playing on that session?
You have Bobby Hackett, Pee Wee, George Brunis, Bud Freeman, Jess Stacy on piano, George Wetling on drums, Artie Shapiro on bass, and who did I leave out? Eddie Condon guitar. And it was difficult to get this session recorded. I had tried to record it about 6 months earlier, and Freeman and Wetling and Jess were in the big bands, and one was with Tommy Dorsey, one was with Benny Goodman, and the other one was with Red Norvo. And the bands travel, and I had to get this band together, I had to do it when everyone was in town. And the other fellows, the bass player, Artie, was working with Joe Marsala at the Hickory House, but Bobby Hackett, Pee Wee, and George Brunis were at Nick's down in the Village, the old Nick's, across from 10th Street. And they all evidently came in town for the Benny Goodman concert. This session was made the day after the Benny Goodman famous Carnegie Hall concert, and two of the titles of the blues I did were Carnegie Drag and Carnegie Jump to commemorate the concert of Benny Goodman at Carnegie Hall. In fact, Benny gave me permission to use Jess on the Commodore date on Monday, and He canceled his date at Victor.
Why don't we hear another selection from that same session?
Oh, the next one I have lined up for is the session after this one. And it's the same band, but with Jack Teagarden on trombone, and it's the famous version, the original version of Embraceable You, which made Bobby Hackett a famous cornetist, and it's his interpretation of it. And I think there's a Pee Wee and a Freeman solo on it also. And it was made after it. Eddie got me to do the session a few months after the other one. I didn't have all the records released yet on 78 of the first session. And we were able to get a Life magazine story on a Commodore recording session. Oh, Life magazine at that time was not in Radio City. It was across the street from the Commodore Music Shop.
Right.
In the Chrysler Building. The Loose Publications were there, and all the writers used to hang out in the store at lunchtime and play records. And so we got this jazz essay. It became a 14-page essay on jazz in Life magazine. Originally, we were supposed to have Pee Wee Russell on the cover, but King Edward abdicated, and we didn't get on the front cover. And they took away space, and the jazz story didn't run until about a month or so later, in the middle of the summer, with some divers going off of a cliff, and Pee Wee's great face was inside within the jazz story. So, and it was about swing and jazz, and I had a list of 30 suggested records to start a jazz hot collection. We call it a hot collection with. And right after that, we sold so many hot records that I opened a store on 52nd Street. But let's play Embraceable You, featuring Bobby Hackett.
Thank you.
That was Embraceable You, one of the Commodore recorded sessions, recorded by my guest Milt Gabler, who's joining us this afternoon. Let's get back to talking about the record shop. What were some of the qualities, you think, about the shop that made it the kind of legend that it has become now?
Well, there have been stories about the shop, but personally, I have been told why it was such a place to hang out by reading articles that were written about the shop, because as I was doing it, I didn't realize it. But I like to talk about jazz music, and so did my customers. And I would think nothing of taking off You're Driving Me Crazy by Guy Lombardo, even though I love Guy Lombardo. I recorded him for many years. I understood what he was putting down. That's what he wanted to do. So, and he was a dear friend of Louis Armstrong, so he's a good man. But the point was, I would take off a pop record. Let's say that was the year that came out. And I would wait. We didn't have booths in the beginning. I would take the record. The only turntable we had was the one that played up over the door, speaker in the door. And we would put on a Duke Ellington record or a Fletcher Henderson record or a Jack Bland Rhythm Maker record, and we would discuss them. And it was a place to hang out in, and never put pressure on anybody to buy a record. And sometimes kids would come in from colleges. We were right across from Grand Central Station, and we would get all the kids from New England, a lot of universities up there. We'd get people in from Princeton, New Jersey, and they were all young people that loved jazz music. And if I thought they were spending more than their allowance or something, I would say, look, only buy two records this week. This one will be here when you come back another week. And that's the way Commodore was.
Tastes were really being formed then, weren't they? I mean, your tastes were formed as you worked at the shop. And
well, I learned
music,
from the customers, and
young.
They learned from me. But the great thing about the store was there was no pressure, and I tried to keep every record made. That's why I reissued records. It used to get me angry when a record would become discontinued, whether it was a jazz record or a show tune, you know, by a singer from one of the Broadway shows. Of course, a lot of those things don't sell enough, and years later when I worked for a big record company, I realized why they were cut out. But when I was a dealer, I used to get upset because I had a special clientele, and they would look for the good things. I remember Frank Norris coming in. Frank Norris was a writer for Town & Country. And he came in after the show Jubilee opened, and he walked in. I used to sell sheet music, too, and I had all the show tunes lined up in those metal racks. And if a show had eight songs, it took eight places in the rack. And he came in, and of course, being a new show, I had that music displayed. And he took out a copy of Begin to Begin, and he said, this is going to be one of the greatest tunes ever written. Cole Porter's Begin to Begin. And it was a beginning, like a Latin tune. Latin music was getting popular then, and in fact, RCA Victor, I guess it was RCA at that point, 1933, they made it by Xavier Cugat. And it's as a beginning, you know, and years later became Artie Shore and Commodore's Eddie Haywood, great record. And it's one of the top tunes of the world today. But Frank Norris knew about it after he saw the show, the only man that came in.
Who were some of your favorite customers? People who we know now who are, you know, now famous either for their compositions, for their writing, for the music. Who used to hang out at your shop and maybe you'd talk
with
them?
Well, I think you mentioned Alec Wilder used to come in. Hoagy Carmichael used to come in. Johnny Mercer used to come in. Those were writers. Great country and western artists later. Tex Ritter used to come in. He had a show on WHN in New York, Cowboy Tom's Roundup, and he lived in Tudor City. And I was the only store that had country and western records. We call them hillbilly records then. And he came in one day. I didn't know who he was, and he asked for, the title went out, Rye Whiskey. He had made a record on White Label Vocalion, a 35-cent record. And I didn't have a lot of Country and Western records. A lot weren't made. And he asked for his record of Rye Whiskey, and I had it. Because, as I said, it was a library-type record shop. If it had a number and came out, I had it. Even the classical records. But I didn't sell many classical. That's how I got into jazz, really, mentioning classical. We had a dinky little 9-foot-2-inch record shop that sold piano rolls and sheet music and still had radio stuff. The classical records, which was big ticket merchandise, were sold by the Gramophone Shop and Land Days on the other side of 42nd Street and Liberty Music Shop and Haynes Griffin, if you remember those old stores in New York. And they were real close to me. And I couldn't compete with them. I didn't have a carpet on the floor, and I wasn't that kind of a guy. And not that I didn't like good, serious music. It's just that I couldn't sell it. I said, what can I sell that the other fellas are throwing away? And it wound up being the music I loved, jazz. I said, nobody, when people come to me and they find a record by Louis, or Duke, they said, God, I haven't been able to get this anywhere in New York. So I said, I better specialize in jazz records because they're just throwing that business away. And this is a figure I used. I said, if only 2% of all the records sold in the United States are jazz, and I sold 1.5% or 75% of that 2%, I would do enough business to keep my doors open. And that was the theory I used as a young guy in high school to go in for jazz records. Because first of all, I loved it. And secondly, nobody else wanted it. Then I had to create an audience for it. So we had jazz concerts. We reissued records. We first people in the world to put the names of the musicians on a 78 RPM label. Who played on them? The date it was made. We made mistakes on some of the first records. But
there's still records that you can't find that information out on now.
That's right. And, of course, now you have LPs and they can print it on the back cover.
Some still don't.
Well.
Really? You still see records. You can't tell when it was made, who's playing on it.
Yeah. But that's what we started, and I'm proud of it.
Were there lots of musicians at the store? You know, as opposed to people who, like, listen to music, were there people who made music hanging around there trying to hear what other people were recording?
Well, they'd be, first of all, those days, the dance band started to work. Across the street was the Commodore Hotel, and running through the Commodore Hotel to play for dancing would be Isham Jones, Tommy Dorsey, Sammy Kaye. Three that I remember. There were more than that. Mildred Bailey used to come into the store, too. Blue Prelude. That was written as a closing theme for Isham Jones Orchestra. It was written by Joe Bishop and Gordon Jenkins. Gordon played piano in that band, and Joe Bishop played flugelhorn, I think. And that became the closing theme for Isham Jones Orchestra. His opening thing was, I can't believe it's true, I think, at the time. Tommy's band, of course, when it went into the Commodore, had Bud Freeman in it and Dave Tuff and Bunny and all those guys. But we were into jazz at that point anyway. And the Lexington Avenue, the Lexington Hotel, had the first Bob Crosby band, the one that came out of Ben Pollock's band. And they went co-op. And, of course, Lombardo was forever at the Roosevelt Hotel. The Biltmore had Whiteman there, and then Gus Arnheim's band went into White's Restaurant on 42nd Street. The bands were playing.
They were
and
around,
the musicians all came in, the sidemen, the arrangers, the singers.
People come in and say, do you have the record that they're on, without telling you who they were, just to
I'll tell you a funny story. Although I recognize him, Hoagy Carmichael came into the store, and he asked to hear, Louis' record had come out on Lazy River, and he asked to hear the record. And I had a crank machine, no electric machine. I used to sell the wind-up portables. And I remember playing it on a Columbia portable for him, and he said, gee, that's great. And he told me who he was, and he had had the same tune out on a Victor, the 38,000 series. I don't know if Bix was on that record or not, but I said to him, I said, Hoagy, you know, it's such a great song and all, and he told me how much he liked the Louis record. I says, how come Louis sings the song better than you do? You know, how come his record is so much better? He says, well, that's Louis, you know, and he just loved Louis' record of his song.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Milt Gabler. We're talking about his Commodore record shop and the Commodore record label. Let's take a pause from our conversation and listen to another one of the sessions that you recorded. And this is a very exciting one, one with Billie Holiday. And we're going to hear her recording of Strange Fruit. And there's an interesting story that accompanies this recording, which I'd like you to tell us about.
You want to hear it before the record?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I already had my store on 52nd Street at that point, and we didn't do a lot of business there because it was on a side street in the middle of the block, and the street only came alive at night when the nightclub was open, the jazz clubs. And then I soon found out that people, when they're going around club jumping, didn't want to carry breakable 78 RPM records in a paper bag with a paper handle. And it just was a great address to mail records from it for me to enjoy myself. And Billy came in one afternoon. Columbia was only two blocks away, block and a half away, really. And she had a sad look on her face, and I asked her what the trouble was, and she said they wouldn't, the company, she was on a Vocalion label, wouldn't record Strange Fruit. And obviously it was the first great protest song ever written. And it was based on Lewis Allen's poem, anti-lynching poem. And it was a beautiful poem, and he set it to music. And she had been singing it at the Cafe Society downtown with Frankie Newton's band. And the company was afraid to record it. Obviously, they probably felt that the dealers and the lower regions of the USA would might boycott them for recording it or something. Anyway, they didn't take the chance. And I said, Billy, if you can get permission from Columbia to record the song for Commodore, I'll make it immediately. I'll make it tomorrow. And the next day she came back in and said she had gotten permission. And
who gave the permission? Was it John Hammond?
Well, I always felt that if John didn't have the authority to give her permission, he would be all for a recording of that song, and that he spoke to one of the brass and said, look, it's a little record label, it don't mean anything, let her record it for Commodore. And that was it was the first big hit record, what you might call hit record, that I ever made, but it was a hit. Strange Fruit got all the attention in the press, but it was a hit for the other side, which was Fine and Mellow, a blues that we cooked up for the session.
Okay, well, let's hear Strange Fruit now, as recorded for Commodore Records with Billie Holiday.
Thank you. then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain together, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree.
Holiday singing Strange Fruit. The album, the record that we heard was produced for Commodore Records, the record label of my guest, Milt Gabler. What was it like to work with Billie Holiday? What were your impressions of
her?
Well,
the years when I worked with her, she was a great artist. There are certain artists that you record through the years that you call one-take artists. They don't have to stay there and sing the song six or seven times until it gets so tired it has no life to it any longer. Billy, if the band was balanced, could get a recording in on one take, two the most. And Bing Crosby was that way, and Louis was that way once he got the words set the way he wanted to do them. Ella Fitzgerald was that way. Peggy Lee was that. All the great ones are that way. They know the way they want to do a song, and they're not experimenting. They're great artists. So she was a pleasure to work with until years later when she got ill. I had her after the Commodore. This first Commodore session was 1939. Of course, I borrowed her from Columbia. So she went back to Columbia, and this record became a big hit. And by letting me record Billy, I created a star for them. And she started selling jukeboxes and everything.
You recorded her again later in her career.
Well, later when the war came and they let her go. And, oh no, there was a recording ban. In 1943, there was a recording ban for about a year and a half. And they let her contract expire, evidently, because she came to me. I was working for Decca in 1943. I joined them in 41. And she said, "Milt, I want to record for you again. I was lucky with you, and Canyon were okay, I think she was then. Nothing is happening." She did records with Teddy Wilson, and she made her own records. And I want to come with you because you understand me, and it was lucky. And I said, "Fine." I was happy to get her back. But first I did... two more Commodore sessions so that I could have an LP. And she was working with Eddie Haywood, and we'll play one of those later. But they were at the Cafe Society downtown. He was a great pianist and arranger. He had just done Begin the Begin with his little band. And what do you call it? I went to Joe Glazer, Billy's manager, and I paid her way over what I pay anybody what she was making at Columbia. And I did the two more sessions so that I would have... I did three more sessions because I have 16 Billie Holiday sides in the Commodore catalog. And then one day I used to always stop into Jimmy Ryan's to say hello and have a drink. And there was a club next door. Forget the name of it. That's not important. I had my drink, and Billy went on next door, and I went into the room, and she was singing Lover Man. And I said, "My God, that's a natural smash hit." I don't know if you know what a natural hit is. During the year, when you're a record producer, an A&R man working for a record company, if you find two natural hits in one year, a natural hit is a song that you almost cannot destroy. No matter who you give it to, it becomes a hit. If you sing it going up in the elevator man says, "Gee, that's a great tune," you know, that's a natural. So I walk in, and she's singing Lover Man, and anybody would know that's a hit. So I said, God, I got to record that immediately before someone steals it from her, some other singer. So I said, Billy, we got to record that song. And then I went home, and I couldn't sleep. I said, if I do it for Commodore, it's going to become a hit, and if it's a hit, Jack Capp will fire me. Because I had to make a decision when I did a jazz record. He didn't care, but I was allowed to make Commodore records while I worked for this commercial company. And I said, that's a commercial hit, even though it's Billie Holiday. So I went up to Jack Capp and I said, I want to record Billie Holiday. I want to give her a con. He says, whatever you say, Milt. I said, we got a smash hit. And I took her away from Commodore because I was afraid the song was going to be a hit. And it became a standard immediately. And the first time and only argument I ever had with Billie, he asked me if I got along with her. She insisted on using strings on that record. She was the first black artist to record with strings that I know of. Now, I know in Downbeat and on the street and all, they'd be screaming that I used strings with Billie Holiday. They wanted a jazz group behind her. And I could see, because this was a kind of a pop tune. When I recorded with Eddie Heywood, those were arranged, the slow tunes. Even though it was six men, it sounded like a commercial record with his pretty fills and things. But this was going to be a larger orchestra, so we got Tutti Camerata, who was a great arranger, and we got the strings for a big string section, five strings. And I think I had Joe Guy playing trumpet a legato on it. And, of course, it's a ballad, so it didn't have much to do with jazz. It was the content of the song.
Why did she want the strings? Did she tell you? Did she think it would sell more?
Just to play pretty.
Or
no.
She thought it would be prettier.
She liked it pretty.
That's something that's always difficult for me to understand, since I always feel that in the typical pop string arrangement backing up a jazz singer, that they're very inhibited and restricted.
Yeah,
by
but
that
the strings don't do anything but just play like you might have a reed section. But they sound pretty to her ears. She and Lester Young and she were very much like that. Like they like poetic, pretty things. In fact, when you go through Billie's career, she might have done a lot of unimportant torch songs, but she lent herself to them, and she sang for losers. And that's why they loved her in the clubs. You could sit there and drink and have had an argument with your girlfriend or boyfriend and broken up a great romance, and she would sing right at you. And that was her thing. And she could swing, but she loved ballads.
So how did those records sell, the ones with strings that you produced for Decca, afraid that they'd become a
terrific
hit?
Terrific! Uh-huh. And I had writers write for her. We wrote things like Good Morning Heartache, Don't Explain. And I remember, it wasn't the Decca period, but after I did Strange Fruit and Find a Mellow, she came to me. She used to write with a fellow named Arthur Herzog. And she had come up, I'm sure it's her idea, she had come up with God Bless the Child. She came into the store with me with the words written on a piece of paper. How do you like it, Milt? And I guess he put a tune to it and helped her with the words, too. But to me, that was her idea, because the lyric in that is Billy. And he made it work as a song. And I looked at that and I said, that's a natural. I couldn't record it. She was a vocalion, an okay artist. But from Lover Man on, she was a Decca artist up until about 1949.
Well, let's hear another one of the recordings that you did record with her for Commodore.
Yeah, this is one with Eddie Heywood's band.
Was this your choice for her to sing, or did she choose it?
Well, we get together, and I try to do tunes that she hadn't made recently on Volcanion or with Teddy, and this evidently at that time was a standard that she liked that she hadn't cut.
This is a tune you probably know, I'll Get By.
Have you, though there be should care. I'll get by as long as I have you.
Billie Holiday singing I'll Get By as recorded for Commodore Records. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Milt Gabler, whose Commodore Record Shop and Commodore Record Label are really legends of jazz. He also has been, worked with MCA and Decca Records for about 30 years, producing a lot of pop records as well as the jazz that he produced with Commodore. I asked you earlier what you thought of your role as producer when you started, producing records for your Commodore record label, and you looked at me and you said, we didn't even have words like producer then. There was no such thing as an A&R man. We hadn't invented that term yet. But what was your attitude as far as your own role within the sessions that you were working on?
Well, I once wrote a piece on it, and the word I used was catalyst. And that's really what an A&R man is, and my definition. Gee, I wish I had. I conceived a definition for what I did, and it's a thing where you put an artist and a song and an arranger and a group of musicians and capable engineers in a studio, and you mix it all together, and you try and get a record that lives, a great record lives, you know, and it's there for all time, just like film. And you have to have it played the way you want and get them to do what you want them to do, the way you conceive the song, and you must never let them know that you're doing it. It's their song and their hit, and all you do is give birth to it, and it's always theirs.
So you have something in your mind that you wanted to get put on record, but you didn't want to make your own presence felt too strongly. You tried to.
Well, I didn't realize it. This is years later. I conceived this definition of it because I made records, produced records later for 25 years. Decca hired me because of the good Commodores I made. And to reissue old Brunswick and Volcanion records, which I got them to buy,